How do you do, boys and girls? This is Edward October. I am the same Edward October you heard on last week's Our True Crime podcast. I shall return next week. Now that I have my own podcast, do you have the feeling that you're surrounded? You are. There's only one escape, YouTube, where a frightening retro horror show entitled Octoberpod is on view. Octoberpod was directed by Edward October. It was produced and edited by Edward October. Oh yes, Mr. October lends his vocal talents to Octoberpod. Why not join the happy hordes of bold individualists and stream Octoberpod? Available now on YouTube, Spotify, Google Play, and at OctoberPodVHS.com. Octoberpod, retro horror for bold individualists. Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. Are we ready to finish this?
Oh, my gosh. I think so. I'm not sure.
He's a real sumbitch.
He is a sumbitch. It is something, I tell you. There's a lot to it. And if it's too many details, hey, that's okay. Well, I'll be back to my short form next because, honestly, I kind of like that better.
It's easier to do, isn't it?
It is, but it's just my attention span.
I know. With the sex lies and duct tape one, that it takes a lot out of you. And it really does.
You know, we've talked about there's a ton I cut out of here. And then there's also some monotonous details I left in because I wanted to show just how ornery, as my mom would say, how ornery, how mean he is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was important to me to show that because the way that I did it is if my mouth kind of opened up and I went, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I would put it in. But anyway, yes, gotcha. I'm ready to wrap the sucker up. You ready?
All right.
Let me just dive right in.
Well, do you want to remind us where we left?
Oh, I'm going.
When we last left Camille and the bully.
Where we last left off, Jen, was our buddy McElroy had went to the tavern and he got out this gun and was like showing it with its, the gun clip.
Showing it off.
You want to see mine? Look how big it is. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so some of the town folk, Pete.
And that's the only thing that he has that's big. Right. Let's put it that way.
Pete Ward and his sons, along with another person named Gary Dowling, had enough. And
right.
They marched down and they demanded that he be taken off the street. So they had, you know, went and did this. So basically their names are out there.
Right.
And when McElroy finds out that it's them, that
hell has no fury.
Ooh.
You know, I wonder what the gun laws in Missouri were at that time. I'd be curious to find out because that's when Reagan came along.
Why don't you look it up?
I will. Because, you know, Reagan came along and after he got shot,
this
he passed
also
some
town.
Very.
And I saw this on Facebook the other day and it harkened back to our day because we lived in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And it said back when I was in high school, people would drive pickup trucks to high school
with
the gun rack,
the
and they would have a gun in it. And I was like, yes, they sure did. So it was just different. It was a different time.
It was a different time. But after Reagan got shot, the Brady Law came into play. Unsure what that Brady Law is, to be quite honest. I don't keep up on my gun laws.
And I'm going to start us off here. Get us going. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
So with all that happening, the judge did, in fact, schedule a hearing in regards to the gun in town incident, shall we call it, for July 10th. And Bard sent notices of the hearing to McFadden, the lawyer, and McElroy, along with copies of the petition. On July 5th, the three Wards, which was, you know, Pete Ward and his two sons and Gary Dowling, all received a notice of the July 10th hearing. Now, you think, it's only 5 days away. They only needed to wait 5 days to ideally get McElroy off the street.
Right.
What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, 5 days is a long time for a psychopath.
Pete Ward had decided that he wanted to gather a bunch of people together to caravan to the hearing. He wanted to show up in big numbers to illustrate to the judge that this person needed to be taken off the street.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted people to show up and let Ken McElroy know that they were not scared of him and they were no longer going to put up with his stuff.
His behaviors.
His behavior. The town was getting pumped up and rowdy. They, you know, when you get in that mob mentality and get all worked up and then it just keeps going. McFadden had called Bard on Wednesday and explained the defense needed a continuance. Of course they did, because he had had a trial scheduled for July 10th, another trial. That afternoon, McFadden sent a letter to Judge Donaldson requesting that the hearing be postponed until July 20th, 1981. The judge granted the request. Friday, July 10th, 1981. People in town had begun to hear about the continuance. They were not happy.
Mm-hmm.
Pickup trucks began arriving in the Skidmore town area, the place where everybody hung out, at around 6:30 in the morning. They were coming in from any and all directions. They were parking wherever they could park. There was a bunch of them. By 8 a.m., both sides of Main Street were lined with trucks. They were trying to decide what needed to be done and how to do it. The talk had ranged from patrolling the streets with posses in order to keep an eye out for him and, you know, let everybody know where he is, kind of stalking him, I guess, spying on him. They also discussed maybe giving the four signers, the four gentlemen that signed the affidavit, permanent 24-hour protection so McElroy couldn't get to them.
Right.
They were done. I mean, they were just getting worked up. They were getting fired up. They were mad. This went on and on. It's been since he was 13.
13.
Yep. It is now 9:30 a.m., and Dorothy, who is McElroy's sister, arrives at his house, and she informs him, hey, you know, there's a bunch of people in a town meeting, and they're discussing you and what to do with you. McElroy tells her, you know what? I already knew about it. He knew it was going to happen. McElroy screams to Tarina to come on out. They're going to head into town. Tarina had said later that she had a really bad feeling about this from the start. And his family also later said that he was not acting like himself. He would always demand a gun go with him. And when he couldn't take a gun, Tarina would take a gun. On this day, he said, nope, no guns, which I think is a little odd.
Which I can't find anything about past laws, but Missouri is a permitless carry state. That means you do not need to have a permit to conceal and carry. Anyone who can legally possess a firearm may carry it concealed in these states without permit license.
As McElroy and Trina approached town, they saw all the trucks parked in town, yet there was no one out and about, which was very odd for a small town. It was all very quiet. There was only one spot left, and it was directly in front of the tavern, ironically. Tarina tried one last time to get him to change his mind. Let's just go back home. But he was adamant. He was going to go into the bar, and they were going to enjoy themselves or harass people.
Exactly. That's the same thing, right?
Yes.
Basically.
They parked the truck, and they went inside the tavern. Red was behind the bar, and there was only one lady inside at the time with her children playing a video game. That was it. The place was empty. Freddie Ulrich had watched as the Silverado pulled into the spot outside the tavern as he was working at the gas station across the street. Aldrich ran to the Legion Hall, which was where all the townspeople were when they were having the meeting about McElroy and discussing what to do. Aldrich whispered into Pete Ward's ear. Nobody could hear him. Ward then announced to all the men that McElroy had just showed up at the tavern. The crowd knew they needed to go to the tavern as they had just discussed that they needed to keep an eye on him, Ken McElroy.
Mm-hmm.
As they exited the building, witnesses would later state that the Sheriff Estes got in his car and drove off in the other direction, while others said that he had left way before it was announced that McElroy was in the tavern. And this would set the idea of he knew what was going to happen, or he thought something was going to happen, and that he was in the clear. I mean, they were trying to cover that up.
Mm-hmm.
As the men approached the tavern, some splintered off and stood outside the gas station, while others stood on the sidewalk across the street. A few decided to return to work as they believed a good, solid plan had been developed amongst them. The tension was strong and growing stronger, with many of them just standing around waiting to see what's going to happen. Because you feel that vibe, something's not right, something's going to happen. Red, on this morning, had arrived at the bar early, as a delivery truck was coming, and he needed to be there for it. When McElroy and Tarina came in shortly after 10 a.m., he served them. Moments later, Del Clement entered the bar and told Red that he better get behind the bar as there was about to be a bunch of people coming inside the bar. And that would be the town folk, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bar soon filled up. Many ordered beer. Some took a seat while others lined the wall, chatting to each other, kind of just standing around watching, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Tarina was looking around and noticed nearly 60 men inside the bar, and she knew most of them by name. No one talked to her, and the only one talking to McElroy was the man who had to sit next to him, as it was the only open bar stool in the place.
So it was very quiet when they walked in.
They were in there first, and then all those people, 60, because, you know, they're all coming in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little creepy. 60 people out of, I mean, that's like, what, one-fifth of the town.
Mm-hmm.
Moments later, a beep from the Silverado sounded. Tarina looked at Ken, who said, he thought they better go now. So somebody purposely hit that horn. Keep that in your mind, right? He ordered a six-pack to go. It's 10 a.m., people. And they made their way to the door. Outside, a little nine-year-old was making her way through the alley near the back of the bar. The back door flew open, and a man with a rifle appeared. Shocked, she stood frozen, and the man told her to go home. She ran home and told her grandma what she had just seen. And her grandma said, don't tell anybody if anyone asked.
Right.
As the McElroys were leaving, whispers soon grew to shouts of get out of town, stay out of town, nobody wants you here, all that stuff. However, either they weren't loud enough or the McElroys were ignoring the shouts because neither one of them responded. McElroy and Tarina were approaching the truck when several of the men inside the bar, in which they were just in, followed out behind them because, you know, they're supposed to keep an eye on him.
Mm-hmm.
McElroy gets in the truck and then Tarina gets inside. They could not see that almost all the men that were inside the bar, minus Red Smith, the bartender, had now come outside to watch or, better yet, stare at them. Ken put a cigarette in his mouth and lit it, placing the lighter next to him. Tarina finally asked him, why are they all staring at us? Steve Peter came up to the window on the side of Tarina and motioned with his hands as if he was, had something to tell her, you know, like roll down the window. So she rolls down the window, and at the same time, she saw Del Clement cross the street behind her. Clement reached inside his truck and pulled out a rifle. Tarina screamed to McElroy, they have guns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole town probably has guns.
At that very moment, the shot rang out and shattered the back window of the truck, striking Ken in the cheek. Tarina started screaming. Another shot rang out, striking Ken a second time. Tarina was screaming to stop shooting as her door was yanked open and a man pulled her out and to the ground, telling her they would shoot her too if she didn't take cover. Another man came to assist them and usher her up the street to the bank, noticing during that time she had wet her pants in all the craziness and frenzy. Shots were now ringing out from every direction. A 12-year-old boy who was getting a soda from the gas station witnessed the chaos and ran home to tell his dad. His father told him, you don't ever say what you saw. Go to your room.
Wow.
Jack Clement was the second man that came to assist Tarina to the bank. That is Dale Clement's father.
Mm-hmm.
Later, a police officer would state only a father, meaning Jack, would be confident in his son's excellent shooting ability that he would run into the line of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he kind of indicating that Dale did it. Most of the men that were on the streets, and at this time, you know, it was around 50-ish, give or take, had dropped down on the ground to take cover, but not all of them. Red, I kind of like Red. Red's my favorite, I think, because I love this. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Red, still inside the bar, heard what he thought were firecrackers and took cover behind the bar with another man. They thought that someone had tried to kill Ken and missed Ken, because it's Ken after all, and now Ken was firing back in a great big shootout. The shooting finally stopped, and a man in the bar looked outside the window and squealed with delight. It was all over, and Ken would not be bothering anyone anymore. Red, still shaking, started giving out beers to everyone inside the bar, and it took a few minutes for Ken to succumb to his injuries. And all this time, the truck is still running. Nobody bothered, turned it off. I think it's funny, Red started giving out beers, but he's not even checking on the guy, right? Just wait, it gets better. Red, still inside the bar, starts cleaning tables and throwing away, you know, empty beer cans, cleaning up. And,
hey.
You know, he had no desire to go outside and see what was happening right outside, and I mean right directly in front of his bar. At 11:15 a.m., now it's approximately an hour after the shooting, Red called the police to inquire, mind you, if anyone had called yet about the shooting. They had. Red would not step foot outside that bar until he left for home at 7 p.m. that night. Now, this is what I like about Red. He calls the police not to say, hey, this guy's been shot, but did anybody call to report the shooting? Yeah, they did. Okay, great. And it had been an hour. Like all this time has passed.
Nobody cares.
Truck's idling.
They hate him.
He's hunched down. So Tarina was still at the bank, and she was huddled in a chair, you know, just unconsolable, right? So some of the bank tellers had tried to get her to go to the restroom and clean herself up because, you know, she kind of wet her pants, which obviously I think most people would in that situation. She also had blood splattered on her shirt from Ken. When the tellers had asked her to go with them, she only started screaming louder, and they had no idea. So they're just like, okay, we're gonna let it know. Well, it came out later that if you remember when Jack Clement took her up there, mm-hmm. he told them to take care of her, meaning to look after her.
Right.
But she thought it was take her out. So she thought the tellers taking her to the bathroom, they were going to kill her. Oh, boy. So the bank manager then calls Tim McElroy to come to the bank to get Tarina because there was an incident. And mm-hmm. Tim was not even shocked. Now, that's McElroy's brother, the baby brother.
They had to have known it was coming. That sooner or later, somebody was going to get revenge and come after him. They can't be shocked.
Yeah. Word was now spreading fast, and many of the people in and around town are jumping in their cars and racing to the scene to see for themselves that there is, in fact, Ken McElroy hunched over his steering wheel of his truck with the engine still running. An instant later, they heard the call for an ambulance on the scanner. Estes, that's the police officers. Estes and Kish jumped in the cruiser, and they took off with lights flashing and the siren howling, and arrived in town at 11:20, like an hour. A few minutes before the ambulance, they arrived. There was no one around in town. The streets were now empty. Kish looked at the Silverado in amazement. The truck was full of holes, and broken glass was everywhere. At this time, Tarina had arrived back at home with Tim McElroy, and she started calling family to tell them what happened. Police are now starting to freak out a little bit, wondering if McElroy's kin are now going to be taking vengeance for his murder and coming after all of them.
That's right. He's got a ton of brothers, doesn't he? And sisters.
McFadden told Tarina she needed to get out of there ASAP because he thought they may be coming for her next. So Tarina hopped in the car and ended up going to the State Patrol headquarters in St. Joe, where she would then give a full statement detailing what had happened and that Dale Clement was the shooter. Although 8 to 10 rifle shots had been fired, only 2 bullets hit Ken McElroy. The first one shattered the rear window in the cab, penetrating his lower neck at the base of the skull and splattered blood onto the top of the seat. The bullet continued through his mouth, tearing through his tongue, his teeth, and his gums before exiting through his lower left cheek. The blast blew the unlit cigarette along with chunks of teeth and flesh onto the dashboard. It's a little explicit, but you know.
I can't say I'm sad. I mean, I feel sorry for his family that loved him.
Which one? Number one, number two, wife number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. Which one?
His family, his parents and siblings, the ones that have to love you.
Another 30-30 slug followed a similar path, but missed McElroy. The high-powered rifle fired at least 2 more shots, which tore into the side of the truck bed, hit the metal wall of the cab, and careened off harmlessly. The second shot that hit McElroy came from a .22, apparently fired from further up the hill, more toward the middle of the street. The shot passed through the rear window, probably knocking out additional glass, and penetrated the upper part of McElroy's skull. This bullet, the .22, was the actual cause of McElroy's death. Although given the time he sat there unattended, like an hour, he would have bled to death from the larger slug. Substantial evidence suggested also that 2 small unexplained wounds in the back of McElroy's neck would or could have easily come from pellets or pellet guns. The spider web cracks in the front windshield looked exactly like those made by BBs. Most important, the metal around the window behind the driver's head had numerous round indentions that, according to the men who later did the bodywork on the truck, stated that they could have been made by shotgun pellets. They pointed out that the cops had not removed the dashboard, which was most likely the resting place for the pellets. That's where they went after they were shot in there. Mm-hmm. They weren't collected. Even if the shotguns were fired, however, it was not the cause of McElroy's death. So think about that into terms. So you have all those people out there. So you got BB guns, you got pellet guns, you got a 22, and then what's that 30-30 thingy?
Like a shotgun is filled with BB pellets, like a shotgun cartridge. There's some shotgun cartridges that are filled with pellets. So when you shoot it out, the pellets go everywhere. They're like ball bearings, shotgun, right? Yeah. It's a shotgun. But a shotgun 30-30 is there is this huge metal slug. It's in a cartridge, but it's just that.
Okay, but my point of this was there was lots of guns out there.
Yeah, but there,
different
I'm
kinds of guns.
Sure there wasn't BB guns. I'd be surprised that there was BB guns. Okay.
All right. David Bard was in the clerk's office on Friday morning when his secretary burst in, pulled him out in the hall, and told him that Ken McElroy had been shot and killed in Skidmore. Bard called the sheriff's office to confirm, and yes, he had been shot and killed. The circumstances created some serious problems, and they are this. The sheriff, with the primary jurisdiction, was actually at that meeting only minutes before the shooting, if you remember. And some testified that he left when the gathering started. Some testified that he left before the gathering started. So that's a little problem there. Also, the man who would be responsible for prosecuting the killer had only days before convicted the man of assault. Okay, so that was Robert Nuri had convicted him of assault. So there's some people are, you know, starting conspiracy theories.
Right.
There we go. The investigation was then turned over to the Northwest Missouri Investigative Squad, or NOMIS. It is a standing task force of lawmen from surrounding counties that come in and deal with special or unique crimes. And I'm guessing that's kind of like a major case squad back in 1981. NOMIS established headquarters in the basement of the Savings and Loan Building in Maryville, and by 2 p.m. on the day of the killing, more than 20 officers from five counties had gathered under the supervision of Sergeant Robert Anderson, Uncle Bob, of the Highway Patrol. Four officers, including Patrolman Boyer, were assigned to interview Dale Clement. They found his wife, Lisa, at home, and guess what? She had no idea where Dale was. When the police officers finally found him and brought him to Maryville for interrogation, his position was simple. And I can just see this, envision this so easily. He pushed a straw cowboy hat back on his head, put his feet on the desk, and said, "Boys, I wish I could say that I'd done it, because he sure had it coming, but I didn't. He stole our livestock, shot our horses, and raped our women." David Bard knew that the investigation and prosecution of the killing would be difficult, but it turned out to be more than difficult, starting with one word that caused the whole world to take notice. Vigilante.
Vigilante.
On Saturday morning, Bard picked up the Kansas City Times from his doorstep and saw on the front page the headline, "Farmer Shot to Death in Apparent Vigilante Attack." Now, of course, the media loves a juicy story, and this was it. I mean, if there was something good made for TV, this is it. Reporters were assigned to the story from everywhere. The two wire services were there, all three networks. Remember, this is 1981. Mm-hmm. The New York Times, the Minneapolis Tribune, the Miami Herald, the Chicago Tribune, the Omaha World Herald, the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, the London Times, Time, Newsweek, you name it, they were there. In fact, Rolling Stone and Playboy magazines even assigned reporters to the scene.
That's kind of a big deal.
60 Minutes gave the story to Morley Safer, which
Morley.
All the world loves stories like this, as we know. The town took care of what the police wouldn't. I mean, what better line is there? When a town wouldn't speak to reporters, it got even better. The town isn't talking. Are they covering for a killer? I mean, come on. This is good stuff. In Tarina's first interview with the New York Times, Tarina told the Times, "It was a setup. They've been having meetings," which was true, to be fair. The Times article did not, however, mention the one fact that would have lent the most support to the conspiracy theory, and that was the meeting that had been held in the Legion Hall only minutes before the shooting. The Times article drew the battle lines. Tarina accused her town of shooting her husband, and the townspeople replied that McElroy got what he deserved and that no one was crying over him. They seemed to accept the moral responsibility for the act, but denied the actual responsibility for it. After all, Ken Rex McElroy, who taught the townspeople himself what they needed to know about the justice system. Because after all, no witness, no crime.
Can I get a witness?
By Wednesday, no progress has been made in the case, although the squad had been beefed up now to 24 officers. Many cops still believe that they could crack the case. They found it simply inconceivable that, with 40 or 50 witnesses, they could not get at least one person to cave. However, they had no idea what or who they were dealing with in Skidmore, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't about to cave. They'd put up with it
long enough. They were fed up.
The following day, one of the men who had been standing on the corner at the gas station crumbled. Tipped off that he was nervous, two officers confronted him at his home and grilled him. When he caved, they took him to Maryville for questioning. He gave a 3-page notarized statement setting forth in detail what had happened that morning. His version substantially confirmed Tarina's statement that Dale Clement had been one of the killers. The officers took him to the prosecuting attorney's office where the statement was reviewed and signed. Here's my favorite part.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, however, there's always a however, the man reappeared with an attorney, the same attorney representing Dale Clement.
Really?
The man said that he had been under stress and duress when he talked to the officers, and that statement, that 3-page mm-hmm. long statement, was not true. So, bam, he's out. Time was running out for the investigation. The original 5-day charter had now been extended another 5 days and would expire on Sunday the 19th. The investigators met at 9 o'clock that morning to review the situation and reach a consensus. They soon realized that there was no reason to continue. No progress had been made, and nothing was going to happen. Unbeknownst to most, the FBI had already stepped in. A few days before NOMIS disbanded, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Missouri had received a letter from McFadden on behalf of Tarina requesting the FBI to investigate the killing. Federal law made it a crime to conspire to deprive someone of his or her civil rights under law. And McFadden's theory was that the sheriff and mayor and perhaps other officials had conspired in that meeting to kill McElroy, thereby depriving him of his civil rights. The government decided to conduct a limited investigation to determine whether Ken McElroy's civil rights had in fact been violated. Because of intense media attention, the FBI investigation was expedited.
Good. It's amazing how it takes media some time to get stuff done.
When people in Skidmore read about the FBI's involvement, the reaction was not good. They believed that the federal government, which had up until now ignored all their pleas for help, were now going to come in and help, and they're going to determine whether or not McElroy's civil rights had been violated after how many rights did he violate and violate them?
Yes, but
often
he,
and daily?
But it's never been proven in a court of law, Camille, so he is, as we know that he sucked.
No,
but
he was charged. He was found guilty.
Well, he
guilty.
Was charged. Oh.
He was found guilty. He was out on,
bail.
Not even, waiting for the second motion to go. Another appeal. A coroner's jury. Do you know what that is, Jen?
A coroner's jury? When mm-hmm. they go over the autopsy report and deem it correct or not?
That's a good guess. I looked this up because I knew if I didn't and I read it, you'd be like, didn't you look that up? So I looked it up. And I didn't know.
Because if you don't know.
A coroner's jury is a body of people convened to assist a coroner in an inquest that is in determining the identity of a deceased person and the cause of death. The laws on its role and function vary by jurisdiction. So, here we go. Coroner's jury met to consider the death of Ken Rex McElroy at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, July 21st. This is 11 days after the killing. Sure. And positive that Dale Clement would be named the killer, Bard had instructed his secretary to prepare an arrest warrant and indictment bearing Clement's name. Media filled the courtroom, anxious to hear the findings. Up first, Deputy Kish testified that he described the scene he had observed as he drove into town and found McElroy in the brown and beige Silverado. Kish described the autopsy and pointed out that the pathologist had said there was 2 bullet wounds and possibly 4. Using photographs, Kish pointed to the wound in the top of the skull as the one that had killed McElroy. Bartender, my buddy,
mm-hmm.
Red Smith, was the next witness. He said he was tending bar when McElroy and his wife came in. Ken ordered a beer, then 50 to 60 people came in, most of whom Red knew, and a few minutes later, Ken bought a 6-pack, and then he and Tarina left, followed by 25 to 30 people. A few minutes later, Red heard what he thought was firecrackers going off, and he realized they were, in fact, bullets, hit the ground behind the bar. And then there was one big boom, a pause, and then a string of explosions, one at a time. Bang, 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 bang. When the shooting stopped, he stood up, still shaking, and served beer to several guys standing at the bar. He didn't go outside, nor did he call the police. He just figured somebody else would. Farmer Harold Kinney said that there were only about 40 people that came into the bar that day, and only 12 people had followed Ken and Trina outside. Kinney had followed them out. He claimed when he heard the gunshots, he didn't look up to see who was shooting. Everyone was running up the street, and he joined them. Looking up the street, he noticed Jack Clement up at the door of the bank with McElroy's wife, Trina. Kinney said he saw no guns. That whole time, he didn't see any guns.
No.
Those people. Nope. Mayor Steve Peter took the stand and testified, quote, I left the bar right behind McElroy. I was 12 to 15 feet from his truck when the shooting began. I saw a side window break out, I guess from a bullet, but I didn't know if it hit him. I dropped to the sidewalk and heard maybe 4 shots in all. Steve couldn't tell where the shots were coming from, and he didn't see anyone with a gun. Just magic gun being shot there, I guess.
Yeah, well, you didn't see it. You didn't see it, Camille. You can't force them. To see something.
The final witness was Trina. She spoke and began breaking down into sobs and wiping tears from her eyes as she went through the whole story. She said that 50 people followed her and Ken out of the tavern, and many of them came over to the passenger side of the Silverado, so they were on the passenger's side. She saw some movement in the crowd, and then Del Clement emerged from the back of the crowd and walked across the street. She kept her eyes on him as he crossed the street and reached inside his car, pulled out a rifle, and walked to the back of the truck on the driver's side. He aimed the gun, and when she turned to tell Ken, the window shattered, and the hole appeared in Ken's neck. She turned back, saw Dale still holding the gun to his shoulder, and heard the second shot ring out. There were 6 witnesses in total, and the hearing lasted 47 minutes. The jury retired to deliberate and return in 27 minutes with the verdict. Ken Rex McElroy had died from a felony committed by a person or persons unknown.
Huh.
That's it. Thanks, Captain Obvious. Seriously, like, we know he's dead and whatever. Like, hello. So that's, they wanted to determine how he died and how it occurred. So that was
right.
All in the coroner's jury. On Monday, July 20th, Judge Monty Wilson, now you remember little Judge Monty was the one that was always scared of him, received Bard's request to impanel a grand jury. On Friday, after the coroner's jury had announced its decision not to name the killers, or couldn't name the killers, Wilson disqualified himself from making the decision to call the grand jury. What a wimp. So that is the second time this guy has disqualified himself because he's still scared of Ken McElroy.
But he's dead. I mean, come on.
He had mailed a notice of his disqualification to the Missouri Supreme Court and had requested that they appoint another judge. Wilson gave no reason for the disqualification, but to the community of Skidmore, there was no mystery. Wilson had been terrified of McElroy during his life and was still terrified of him and his, quote-unquote, friends and family after he was gone, which I believe because, my God, whatever. On Monday, July 27th, the Missouri Supreme Court appointed Circuit Judge Conley from Columbia, Missouri, to hear Bard's request. On Tuesday, Judge Conley granted the request and ordered the grand jury for the following Saturday. But the grand jury would not meet to begin taking evidence until August 11th, and then it would consider other matters in addition to the killing. Almost 2 months would pass before the jury would reach a decision on whether to indict someone for the killing of Ken Rex McElroy. Grand jury met in secret, issued subpoenas, and put witnesses under oath, which meant that the witnesses could be prosecuted for perjury, meaning they had to tell the truth. Duh. Trina announced that she was offering a $5,000 reward for anyone supplying information to authorities which leads to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for the murder of Ken Rex McElroy.
Wow.
The only catch was that the reward would have to be paid from the proceeds of the sale of Trina's movie rights because she didn't have any money. Can't make that up.
Well,
the grand jury met for the first time on August 11th, but did not turn to the killing until August 20th. The press kept the story alive. The grand jury subpoenas went out, and the recipients were eager to know who else was on the list. Those had been outside the tavern at the time of the killing but claimed not to have seen anything were particularly nervous. They talked about what was going to happen, but it was all kind of whatever, right? It was done. The first day, 8 residents testified. Tarina testified on Friday. She arrived in a 3-piece suit with a briefcase in her hand. A vote of 8 of the 12 members of the grand jury was required for indictment. Although Tarina had identified Del Clement as a killer, no one else had backed her up. That's crazy, isn't it?
That's nuts.
September 25th, the final day of the grand jury session, Bard called a press conference to announce that the grand jury would issue no indictments in the McElroy case. He distributed a news release explaining that the grand jury had heard 45 witnesses and more than 8 days of testimony and had not found probable cause to return an indictment. So with this announcement, it seemingly let Bard and the killers off the hook. It also meant Skidmore would now be known as the town that killed the town bully.
Yay.
The
Ding
town.
Dong, the bitch is dead.
The town and what it did would live on long after the fact. In March 1982, when it was clear that nothing further was going to be done on the local level, the FBI launched a major investigation. In April, they sent a team of 10 agents into the field under the supervision of an attorney from the Justice Department. The agents interviewed more than 100 witnesses, questioning many of them several times, and issued 60 subpoenas to appear in front of the federal grand jury. The townspeople knew that the FBI was involved in the case, but the federal invasion of the community caught most people by surprise. Although the agent's sudden appearance made everybody nervous, it sparked a lot of laughter. I mean, here comes these dressed up cops, you know, these dressed up FBI agents in their little suits and everything. And they're, you know, go eat at Mom's Cafe next to the farmers in their hats and stuff. So, you know, is there like the
right
agents from this, from the big city?
What was, I guess Kansas City would have been the closest
Kansas
big city.
Yeah. The agents hit the pavement, or in this case, gravel roads, and started talking to farmers, demanding to know who shot McElroy. And not one person would budge. Tarina and Alice were being hounded by the press nonstop. Alice tried to buy a house nearby, but the agent called her just a few days before to say that the neighbors did not want her or any kids around. They didn't want to be associated with them.
Right.
The 60 Minutes profile of the town aired on January 24th, 1982. Morley Safer described it as a town that had seen better days. While saying that McElroy was a bad character and that the townspeople probably had no choice, the 60 Minutes segment pondered some ethical questions, such as, is it okay to take a life? Is
vigilantism?
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Dunbar, who was used to be the marshal, his interview was chopped up and made him look like he was a big old chicken.
Mm-hmm.
The highlight of the program was Bo and Lewis, Bo and Camp, Tim Warden, and Romaine Henry, and they were all sitting at a dining room table. Lois, in her rather gutsy, I guess, style, proclaimed that everyone in town was resting much better now that McElroy was gone. Morley Safer asked them in turn if they would identify the killer if they knew who it was. Each one said no. Finally, on November 11th, 1982, Bard announced that the federal grand jury material did not contain substantial new evidence and that, therefore, no charges would be forthcoming. The case would remain open. Alice and Tarina, who had, up until this time, remained close during all of this turmoil, ended up ending their friendship. On April 2nd, 1984, Tarina married again. She married a roofer. Roof. Did I say that right, Jen? Roofer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a guy that does a roof, who was in his 40s and had lived in a little town nearby. On July 9th, 1984, one day before the 3-year statute of limitations would have expired, Tarina filed lawsuits in state and federal courts against the city of Skidmore, Nottoway County, Danny Estes, Steve Peter, and Del Clement for the death of her husband. In federal court, she alleged that the defendants had knowingly violated Ken McElroy's civil rights under code of law. She sought $3 million in damages, including $2 million for the loss of support services and companionship, $3 million in punitive damages because of the reckless and wanton nature of the acts, and $1 million for her own pain and suffering. In February 1985, the defendants took Tarina's deposition. It was a mess. She was all over the place. So guess what? She decided, Nah, she didn't want to do it. She canceled the lawsuit. On September 5th, 1985, the form announced that the suit had been settled, but that under the agreement, the parties could not release the terms. Townspeople had little trouble finding out the terms. Tarina received $17,500 from the defendants. Nottoway County paid $12,500. Dale Clement paid $3,000, and the town of Skidmore paid $2,000. That was what her suit. Dale and Greg Clement sold the D&G Tavern in 1982. The couple who bought the bar renamed it Robin's Nest after the woman, but many people still called it the D&G. Dale Clement would die from injuries suffered one night when he was driving home from St. Joe and his pickup truck jumped a barrier on the interstate. He maintained all that time, "I was wrongly accused, and that's all I have to say." Most of the buildings in Skidmore are now boarded up, if they are still standing at all. Skidmore would be in the news a few more times since the killing of Ken Rex McElroy. In October 2000, Wendy Gillenwater was stomped to death by her boyfriend, who is now serving a life sentence in prison. In April 2001, 20-year-old Branson Perry disappeared from his front yard. He hadn't been seen since. He simply vanished after saying he was going to go outside to return jumper cables to the shed. In 2004, a former minister, Jack Wayne Rogers, was sentenced to 30 years for a string of pornography charges. Oh, and cutting off a man's genitals.
Oh, that kind of goes together.
Authorities,
I guess, right?
searched his home looking for evidence that would implicate him in Perry's disappearance and or death. Rogers has denied killing Perry and was never charged in the case, although there was some evidence on his computer stating that he knew what happened to Perry. That case still remains unsolved today, and I won't tell you. It was a very detailed description of how he was raped and murdered and all that good stuff. It's terrible. In December 2004, you might remember this, I did, 36-year-old Lisa Montgomery would walk into a very pregnant 23-year-old Bobby Joe Stennett's house. And she was, incidentally, a cousin of Branson Perry. Stennett was. Choke her with a rope and cut out her unborn baby from her swollen belly.
That.
And claim the girl as her own. The baby would survive and would be given back to her father. Most of the people originally involved have now passed on or moved away from the story. I guess it begs to ask, do you think that Ken McElroy went into town unarmed when he knew the community was holding a meeting about him? And sort of, I guess we know it today by death by cop, suicide by cop.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he knew that he wanted that to happen rather than to go to jail because he was old and unhealthy. Or if it was just, you know, it just unfolded as it did.
Well, considering he probably never left the house without being armed, then he probably did intentionally do it for suicide by
I just think that he,
cop or
he,
other people. Or
and it was coming. I mean, he was either going to go to prison or somebody was going to take him out. And maybe just getting tired of that all the time. Like I said, there were so many things that, like, I don't know, somebody would stare at and he'd pull over, pull out his gun on him. Like,
yeah.
And they'd be, you know, in their field plowing corn and, you know, just out of nowhere. He just literally.
The autopsy didn't find anything unusual. Like, he didn't have a brain tumor. Like,
he was injured when he was young and he had the plate.
Right.
He said he had a steel plate in
his
head.
But he did not.
But he was injured as a kid, which brings me to the other thing that I brought up in one of the other episodes. So I was watching a show, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And just.
That's what you do.
I know. Coincidentally, I ended up watching like 5 episodes in a row. And they weren't all in a row in the show because, like, I'll go and look at what they're about and then jump around to what I think is interesting. But every single one of them had a major brain injury when they were a kid.
Yeah.
And they ended up becoming a violent killer. And I don't know. That just stuck with me because it's kind of like this. You know, are you born bad? I don't know. Some people are, I think. Some people, I don't know. Maybe it is a brain injury.
I don't know. Well, you know that Teresa Hilt that we did, where she was killed and nobody knew to this day, everything's missing. She's from up in that area too. So it makes you wonder if something's in the
atmosphere. There was some stuff that I was reading that there was a lot of crime going on there because people thought they could get away with it, you know?
Right.
But I mean, maybe it's just a small town and that happened. Population's now dwindled to, what did I say, 281 or 261?
Yeah.
It's tiny.
It's
but it was only
tiny.
400 something then. So anyway, that's what I got. I know it was long and drawn out and it just...
Well, I can't wait to watch the Sundance.
There was a lot to it.
Show. Yeah, my dad and I used to have fights who would get to watch 60 Minutes or who would get to watch...
Disney.
Brady Boys or Brady Boys.
Hardy Boys.
Hardy Boys mystery. And if it was the Nancy Drew instead of Hardy Boys, he got to watch 60 Minutes. Yeah, but if it was Hardy Boys, I got to watch the Hardy Boys. But then one year, I got a little 9-inch black and white TV for my room for Christmas because Dad was tired of watching Hardy Boys.
Funny.
Yeah.
All right, Jen, that's all I got. You want to tell right. people where they can find us, or we talked out and they can.
Well, you guys can find us if you have any questions or comments. Please email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter, where we are very talkative and on there all the time, it seems, at ourtruecrimepod. If we do have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast, if you feel that you would like to help us out and support the show monthly, or you could do a one-time donation for our PayPal. And if you go to our website, www.ourtruecrimepodcast.com, there will be a donate button. Anyway, you press that, do a one-time donation. That would help us out. You may also go to our Etsy store, which also is, there's a link on our webpage, and buy some logo branded shirts and such, I think. Is that it? I think that's it. That's it for now. I think you're probably tired of our voices.
Yeah, I am. I'll tell you that.
I'm tired of our voices too. Thank you very much for listening. We know it's been long, but we really appreciate it. We appreciate your support and your time. We appreciate your support and the time. So thank you very much. So anyway, what do?
We lock our doors.
And we keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
That is
two.
No, it's a letter B, Jen. It's a letter B. Vigilante. No witness, no crime.
No witness.
No witness. No crime.
Can I get a witness?
Okay. Estes had said privately that there would be no further
privately. It's private. Remember the private
school? I'm sorry, private school at
Saint Louis.
Do I
think so.
Whatever. The coroner's jury.
Coroner's
down at the Saint private school.
Private.
I said it wrong on purpose because I said Saint and coroner wrong. See,
no, you said Saint right.
Well, I don't know if I, because I said, I'm going to hate you. I can't wait till you do your story.
I do everything fine.
Every word
you can, and I will totally make fun of it too. No, I don't. I don't get mad.
No, stop. Okay, hold on. Where was I?
I don't get mad.
Yeah, you get even, which is even worse. Where did the second shot ring out? Nope. No. Okay.